Good morning. Welcome again to the live webcast coming to you from Tree of Life Christian Church in Chatsworth, California. Glad to have you with us this morning. Please join me in the scriptures. Genesis chapter 14. While you're turning there, next week we won't have a webcast. We have our all-church gathering at the church offices, so look forward to seeing everybody together next week there. And then, Lord willing, we will be back with the webcast 2 weeks from today and continuing our study, as we're doing today, on the names of God. Now, where we're at this morning is we're to part 8 in our study on God's names. The fundamental principles that we've established so far is that God has chosen to reveal himself to us through the declaration of names that he's chosen for himself. We didn't choose these names for God. The writers of Scripture didn't choose these names for God. God chose these names for himself. And he chose more than one name because there's more than one aspect of God's nature, character, his attributes, and what we need to understand about his relationship to us that's important for us to understand. And so each name is like a piece of a puzzle. We're putting together, as we're studying each individual piece, we're starting to link them together piece to piece, name to name, and hopefully by the end of our study we will have built a deeper overall perspective of who God is and exactly what he wants us to understand that he is like. Now, we've studied so far through the Old Testament the primary Old Testament names of God, Yahweh, which is the most used name of the Lord, and the most important in a certain sense. We've studied Elohim. We've studied Adonai, the Lord. And last study, we studied El Shaddai, which is the first of what I'm calling the combination names. These are names in which there is a root name, El, which is the same root as Elohim, and it's combined with another important word which together conveys a certain aspect of God's power and strength revealed in a specific way into our lives. And we saw that from El Shaddai, God is translated in our English version, God Almighty. But it's God's power in a specific way in our lives, experienced in a specific way, which is the fullness of God's sufficient power to meet the needs of those he identifies as his covenant people. Now today what we're going to do is we're going to attempt to tackle more than one name of the Lord, and we're still dealing with El names. It's E-L as you would spell it from the Hebrew, and that name, that root name, means mighty or powerful. But we're going to look at different combinations, the ones that I would like to cover today, and we'll just see how far we get. I don't know how much I'll get accomplished this morning. We're going to look at the names El Elyon, El Olam, El Kana, El Roi, El Dia, El Kadosh, El Gibor, and El Jeshurun. Now, as I said all of those, it just sounds interesting, right? But nevertheless, unless we happen to be, and I'm not, most of us probably aren't fluent in Hebrew, it just sounds interesting, but we're not really sure of the concepts that are connected to that. But remember, for each one of these names, as God revealed these names to his people in this, they in turn then used that name in communication back to God and to one another, they were hearing specific concepts. Because it would be like, for instance, El Elyon, it would be like saying, instead of me saying the words El Elyon, God Most High. So let's look at that name first, El Elyon. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 14. We'll read the first use of this name, El Elyon, as we find it in this story from Abram's life and his interaction with this mysterious figure, Melchizedek. And we'll read from verse 11, and I'll read through to the end of chapter 14. This is a circumstance in which there is a great battle in the region where Abraham is living at this time. And there's four kings that are battling against five kings, two great alliances in the ancient world. And in the battle, one of the alliances actually kidnaps the people of the city of Sodom, where Abram's nephew, Lot, happens to be living with his family. And word comes back to Abram, and he responds to this event. So verse 11, the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, and went their way. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, the brother of Eshcol and Aner. These were allies of Abram. And when Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men, born in his house, 318 of them. This is a small army that he assembles here. And he went in pursuit as far as Dan. And he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus. Then he brought back all the possessions, and also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions, and the women and the people. After his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is, the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of El Elyon, God Most High. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram by El Elyon, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be El Elyon, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." So we see an interaction going on here between Abram and Melchizedek, who meets him at the conclusion of this victorious battle. And three times Melchizedek refers to God by this name, El Elyon. And Abram, in response, gives Melchizedek a tenth of everything. And the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself." But Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have lifted up my hand to Yahweh, El Elyon, possessor of heaven and earth, that I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you should say, 'I have made Abram rich.' I will take nothing but what the young men have eaten and share, and the share of the young men who went, the men who went with me. Let Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre take their share." All right. So in this exchange, first an exchange between Abram and Melchizedek, and then immediately following that, an exchange between Abram and the king of Sodom, who has been delivered by the benefit of Abram's army and the victory that he's accomplished over these other allied kings. In this exchange, Melchizedek refers to the Lord as El Elyon, which is translated properly, God Most High. It's a good, solid translation here. And then, in a further exchange with the king of Sodom, Abram also uses this same name. Now, of course, Abram knows the Lord as Yahweh, and we saw in our study last week that he really knows the Lord as El Shaddai, the one who is all-sufficient to meet his needs in his covenant relationship with the Lord. But here he uses another name following the example, or the lead, in a sense, set by Melchizedek. Because as he returns, Melchizedek greets him, Melchizedek blesses him, blesses the Lord, and serves what we would consider to be kind of like a rudimentary communion meal. He serves him bread and wine. He serves him a celebratory meal based upon the great victory that he's accomplished. It's a victory feast, but it's a worshiping victory feast. It's not just a human level meal. There's some spiritual significance to this meal that he serves him. And in doing so, Melchizedek calls on the name of El Elyon, God Most High. Now, in this particular name, it's an interesting name. While it's translated properly, God Most High, the root of it literally means that which is, or the one who is hidden. The one who is hidden. And the idea here, That's the next name. I just glanced down at the wrong part of my notes. Forget that. Scratch that out. He's not the one who's hidden. He is the one who's hidden, but according to a different name. And I'm sorry for confusing you there. It means, it's a comparative name, El Elyon, God Most High. It means the one who is high in comparison or in relationship to someone or something else. It's like a list name. If we were to sit down and say, let's list out all of the high things in life, the sense of comparison is that El Elyon means this one that I'm referring to belongs at the top of that list of comparison. Now, what's being compared here in this particular case is what? Who is Melchizedek? Because he's the first one that uses this name. And then Abram, following his example, also uses the same name. But who is Melchizedek comparing the Lord to? And who is he speaking these words to? He's speaking the words to Abram, but he's got, in a sense, like an audience of all of those who are gathered with Abram, listening to him. Who is he comparing the Lord to? He is, exactly that. He's comparing him to the other gods. Specifically in this case, the other gods of the kings that he has just defeated in battle. The men that he defeated in battle, the armies, the allied armies that he defeated in battle, we don't have the exact number, how large they are, how powerful they are, but the implication is the specific number of soldiers that Abram recruited to this battle from his own household were given as 318. The point of giving that number is to, in a sense, show the battle that he is about to go out and fight and win is a battle of greater forces against his lesser forces. On a human level, on a natural level, he is going out to fight with five kings who were allied against him and all of the armies that are represented by those five kings. And Abram defeats them with 318 men. This is somewhat similar to the story that we're all familiar with from later in the book of Judges. You know, when we have that famous story of Gideon's 300 who defeat this over 160,000 man army. And in both cases, what we're dealing with is the blessing of El Elyon. The idea is that in comparison to the blessing of God upon these other kings and their armies, the blessing of God Most High is so far superior, so far above that blessing, that Abraham cannot help but win this battle. And so it's a comparative term in the sense of we're comparing God to other gods. Now, we go on into the New Testament and we learn, of course, and we understand this, how many gods actually exist? One. There aren't other gods. But in the perspective of the peoples of this world around us, there always have been, there are today, and there always will be many other gods that are worshipped. These are gods of their imagination, god of their own devices, god of their own making. Now, I've shared the story many times about my trip to India back in 2001, and the way India works is a spiritual culture in which they worship literally, according to their count, their estimation, 100 million different gods in Hinduism. And that's just one religion of the world. Each religion of the world represents its own god or gods to the people that follow that religion. And so this is a comparative term in which the Lord is comparing himself to the gods of the minds and hearts of the other people for the sake of making it clear and obvious which is the one true God. So this concept of El Elyon is very similar to what we would describe as the one true God concept. But he does it by, on purpose, bringing himself down to the level of saying, okay, you want to compare who is the greater God here? Who is higher among these different belief systems, these different concepts of religion? I am the one true God who is the most high in comparison to all other gods. Now let's look at another passage in Psalm 47 that uses this same term. Psalm 47. We'll read the first 9 verses. This is, of course, a worship song, but it uses the same designation and does so in a different combination, slightly different. This one, the actual name is Yahweh Elyon, which is the Lord Most High, but the same root concept. Psalm 47, clap your hands, all people shout to Elohim with loud songs of joy for Yahweh Elyon. The Lord Most High is to be feared, a great king over all the earth. He subdued peoples under us and nations under our feet. He chose our heritage for us, the pride of Jacob, whom he loves, Selah. God has gone up with a shout, the Lord with the sound of a trumpet. Sing praises to God. Sing praises. Sing praises to our King. Sing praises. For God is the King of all the earth. Sing praises with a psalm. God reigns over the nations. God sits on his holy throne. The princes of the people gather, and the people of the God of Abraham. For the shields of the earth belong to God. He is highly exalted. This is a worship song, but it's also a battle song. It's similar to the song that we're familiar with that was sung during the Civil War period, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, in which there is a march to battle call here in this particular worship song. And the battle is against not just Israel's forces and the other nations around them on a human level. The ultimate battle, as Michael said earlier, is a battle between the one true, most high God and the gods of all the nations around who are worshipped in ignorance and foolishness by the idolatrous peoples of the world. And so the idea of the one true, most high God is that it is, in a sense, an evangelism term. It's a term that we would use in our communication to describe an attribute of God that is unique to Him alone among all the concepts of God that anyone that will ever run into out in the world holds, in which we say, He, this God that we worship, the Father of the Lord Jesus, our one true God, is the Most High God. He is above any concept that you hold in your heart about God and about who He is. Let's look at one other passage on this, and this is from Daniel chapter 4. Turn over to the prophet Daniel. This is from the story of Nebuchadnezzar's life. We're familiar with Nebuchadnezzar. He was, at this time in history, he was the king of Babylon. Babylon happened to be the most powerful nation on the face of the earth by God's doing. They were the most powerful on the face of the earth at this time because of the disobedience and rebellion of Israel. And the Lord had used Babylon to discipline His people Israel in their rebellion. But because the Lord had raised Babylon up to a position of such great prominence, and because Nebuchadnezzar was such a great king, he became exalted and lifted up in his own perspective. And we're going to read the story of what happens to him starting in chapter 4, verse 30. This is the king Nebuchadnezzar as he's walking on the roof of his royal palace, looking out over the what we know from archaeology is the famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon, this beautiful and glorious city that he's built. And the king answered in verse 30 and said, "Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty?" While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven, "O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you, and you shall be driven from among men. Your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. You shall be made to eat grass like an ox. In 7 periods of time," this turned out to be 7 years, "shall pass over you until you know that Elyon rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he wills." Immediately the word was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from among men. He ate grass like an ox. His body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers. His nails were like bird's claws. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven. This is 7 years later now. And my reason returned to me. And I blessed Elyon and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say to him, 'What have you done?' At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and splendor returned to me. my counselors and my Lord sought me, and I was established in my kingdom, and still more greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for his works are right, and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride he is able to humble. Now, in this famous story from Nebuchadnezzar's life, the name Elyon is used twice. It's slightly different here. It's not El Elyon, it's just Elyon. And this is something that you'll find in your study through the Old Testament. Many times the Lord's name is referred to as El Elyon. Other times, just the Elyon part, the Most High. Well, he's even referred to in our translation as the Most High in that way, without referring to God specifically. But it's clear who is being referred to. And so Nebuchadnezzar has, in his great pride, his exalted heart perspective about himself, he has this encounter with the Lord in which the Lord judges him. And the Lord chooses to use Nebuchadnezzar as an object lesson to speak to the entire nation of Babylon and to speak to the entire nation of Israel, who's in captivity at this time, to Babylon. And what's the message? The message is the message of the Most High, Elyon, the one who's really in charge. And so the concept of Most High, it's a comparative term, but it came to mean the one who is in charge of everything and everyone. And that's what it ultimately meant for Nebuchadnezzar. In our first occurrence, we saw from Melchizedek's testimony that he referred to El Elyon as the possessor of heaven and earth. That's essentially the same conclusion that Nebuchadnezzar comes to, that God possesses me. He's in charge of me. I belong to him. I cannot exalt myself above him. He is always above and exalted in relationship to me. Now, how does this relate to your life and to my life? Well, in whatever circumstance you find yourself in, there are times in which we may wonder or question who's really in charge. We may wonder or question whether God is really seated enthroned over this particular circumstance that I'm passing through. And when we're most challenged on that is not usually through the easy times and the times that things are going smooth and things are going exactly the way we'd want them to go. The greatest challenges to the concept of whether God is really Most High is when other things seem to be putting themselves forward as being in charge of our life and our circumstances. Other influences, other people, other circumstances beyond our control. And the name El Elyon is a very helpful focal point of worship for our hearts to recognize that He alone is the possessor of heaven and earth. He alone is exalted above this circumstance. He is in charge, no matter what it may look like as I first glance at it. If I learn the deeper lesson that Melchizedek proclaimed, that Abraham had learned from his battle, that Nebuchadnezzar learned in the midst of the judgment of the Lord, then I will declare him to be the Most High. All right, let's turn back to Genesis chapter 21. We'll look at the second of the El names in our list for today. El Olam. Now this one is translated, as we'll see, God Everlasting. And this is where the note that I wanted to give you earlier comes into play. The meaning of this, as you're turning to Genesis 21, is literally the hidden one or the concealed one. But it comes to mean everlasting, and I'll explain in a moment what the connection is between hiddenness and the concept that God is the everlasting one. We'll read another story here from the life of Abraham, chapter 21, starting in verse 22. At that time, Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, said to Abraham, God is with us, with you in all that you do. This is Elohim. Elohim is with you in all that you do. Now, therefore, swear to me here by Elohim that you will not deal falsely with me or with my descendants or with my posterity, but as I have dealt kindly with you, so you will deal with me and with the land where you have sojourned. And Abraham said, I will swear. Okay, Abimelech was a king in this region. And Abraham, while not a king, was the most powerful, richest, and most influential individual man on the face of the earth at this time. And so Abimelech comes to Abraham out of respect and consideration of his power and influence, and he asks to enter into what we would consider to be kind of like a covenant relationship, in which they're going to swear allegiance to each other in this situation. When in verse 25, when Abraham reproved Abimelech about a well of water that Abimelech's servants had seized, Abimelech said, "I do not know who has done this thing. You did not tell me, and I have not heard of it until today." So Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech. The two men made a covenant. Abraham set 7 ewe lambs for the flock apart. Abimelech said to Abraham, "What is the meaning of these 7 ewe lambs that you have set apart?" He said, "These 7 ewe lambs you will take from my hand, that this may be a witness for me that I dug this well." Therefore, that place was called Beersheba, because there both of them swore an oath. It means the well of oath. So they made a covenant at Beersheba. Then Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of the army, rose up and returned to the land of the Philistines. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba and called there on the name of Yahweh, El Olam. And Abraham sojourned many days in the land of the Philistines. So at the end of this initial agreement, alliance with Abimelech, and then later after they made an initial agreement, there was a dispute that arose because some of Abimelech's men did something inappropriate to a well of water. And in those days, in this culture, in this part of the world, water was, fresh water was a hugely important resource, very valuable resource. So Abimelech's men had done something to this well. It comes to Abraham's attention. This could be, between two allied men, cause for there to be a war, a battle between them. And so there's this exchange that has to be resolved, this dispute that has to be resolved between Abimelech and between Abraham, like two kings in a negotiation with each other over this well. And Abraham resolves it in a peaceful way. He didn't owe Abimelech 7 ewe lambs. He could have just demanded to receive the well back in pristine condition because it was Abimelech's fault that it happened from the beginning. But Abraham nevertheless gave him 7 ewe lambs as a covenantal exchange to say, "These lambs, this gift will be my witness that this well, from this point forward, always belongs to me. I dug this. It's mine." There'll never again be a dispute over this. And Abimelech agrees, they enter into this covenant, and they go on from that well. But before he leaves, Abraham does something very interesting. He plants a tree at the side of this well. And he does this not because he's trying to earn carbon credits for himself, you know, in a concern about global warming. Why does he plant this tree at the side of this well? And why this particular kind of tree? It's mentioned, the kind of tree is mentioned, and whenever you see a detail like that where the tree is named, there's probably something involved with the tree itself. He plants a tamarisk tree. Now, you might have information in your study Bibles about the tamarisk tree. It was two things. It was a very long-lived tree, and it was an evergreen, okay? And in that culture, because of the length of its life and because of the nature of the tree as an evergreen, it came to signify something of permanence. It would last beyond a single generation of human life. So you planted a tamarisk tree and your children would see that tree as long as it remained healthy. And your grandchildren would see that tree and your grandchildren's children would see that tree. And so there's this sense of permanence about it. And there, as he plants the tamarisk tree, he calls on the name of Yahweh, El Olam, which means the everlasting God. But I said the root meaning of the word actually means something hidden or concealed. And the idea here is this is referring to God's characteristic as being what we would call the Eternal One. And in the sense that he's the Eternal One, that aspect of him, his nature, is somewhat hidden from our sight. We see God as he's active in our lives today and in the context of our experience. that God has been God from before the foundation of the world, from before history. And He will be God after this world as we know it comes to an end. He is eternal and everlasting, but that beginning part, though it's not actually a beginning, before history, and that ending part, though it's not actually an ending, after the end of history, those aspects of God's eternal nature are somewhat concealed from us because we've never been back there and we haven't yet been forward to that point. And so we can only trust and believe that God is truly eternal by faith because He declares this about Himself. And so now, as Abram comes into this circumstance in which a dispute with another important individual in his life is resolved and a covenant is formed, and now we have to have a starting point from this covenant to go forward, you and I, and to have a right and close relationship with each other without ongoing issues and friction and dispute between us. How can we do that? How can we? Because you know how it is. Moods shift. People's opinions and attitudes and perspectives change from day to day. I'm not in the same mood today that I was if you ran into me yesterday. And I probably won't be in the same mood tomorrow. With all of that changeableness about me, and the same thing goes on with you, how can we have confidence that we'll be able to have a good and healthy and solid relationship with each other going forward? There's only one way, is by finding our common connection to the everlasting one, the one who never changes, the one from eternity past and eternity future who remains constant, permanent, and unchanging in the midst of every single moment of our lives. And so I place my faith in Him, you place your faith in Him, and in that common connection to Him as the everlasting one, we find ground, as Abraham did with Abimelech, to go forward and to be at peace with one another, because the everlasting one rules over our relationship and our circumstances. Let's read from Psalm 90. Psalm 90. Another occurrence of El Olam. That's in English, O-L-A-M. Psalm 90, I'll read the first four verses. This is a prayer of Moses, the man of God. We actually have turned this, not we didn't do this, but some writer turned these lyrics into one of the songs that we sing in worship. Lord, You have been our dwelling place in all generations. I think our song says, in every generation. Lord, You have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever You had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, You are God. The wording there is, from Olam to Olam, You are El. You return man to dust and say, return, O children of men, or man. For in verse 4, a familiar verse to us, Peter actually later quotes this verse and then applies it in a slightly different way in making a point in the New Covenant. For 1,000 years in Your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night. He is El from Olam, from everlasting, from eternity past, to Olam, eternity future. And because He is there in those eternal bookends which surround any single moment of our life, we can have 100% confidence in the midst of whatever circumstance He places us in today and tomorrow and the next day, because He is the everlasting one. One more passage on this, Psalm 93. We're right near there. Turn to Psalm 93. We'll read the first five verses. Now, it looks like I'll only get the first three of these done today if you're trying to schedule your notes here. Psalm 93. I'll read the first five. Yahweh reigns. He is robed in majesty. Yahweh is robed. He has put on strength as his belt. Yes, the world is established. It shall never be moved. Your throne is established from of old. You are from Olam, from everlasting, from eternity. The floods have lifted up, O Yahweh. The floods have lifted up their voice. The floods lift up their roaring, mightier than the thunders of many waters, mightier than the waves of the sea. The Lord, Yahweh on high, is mighty. Your decrees are very trustworthy. Holiness befits your house, O Yahweh, forevermore. Now, the concept of God as the one who is Olam, everlasting, is introduced in this worship song in a very important context. He is referred to as the everlasting one in the midst of floods of waters. The idea here is, okay, when do we most need to remember that God is El Olam in our life? It's when you're in the midst of the flood. You know, it's when the waters are flowing higher than you can swim through. It's when you are overwhelmed. It's when things are just too challenging, too difficult, and you're not sure left to yourself if you're going to make it through this situation. At that moment, it's critical that you remember His characteristic as the everlasting one. I'm not rooted in this flood. I'm rooted in the everlasting one. I'm rooted in the one who was there before the flood started and who will be there after the flood ends, and the one who will therefore get me through this flood with me being above the waters like Noah rather than underneath them. All right. Let me just read real quickly. You don't need to turn there. One verse from the New Testament as a parallel to this concept. This is from 1 Timothy 1:17, if you want it in your notes. We had turned this into a worship song a few years ago also. In the old translation, the New American Standard that we used to read from it, it read, "Unto the King Eternal." Here in the English Standard Version, it reads, "To the King of Ages, immortal, invisible, the only God, be honor and glory forever and ever. Amen." That phrase, King of Ages, bears the exact same concept now in the New Testament that El Olam bears in the Old Testament. He is the King before the ages began, throughout every single age of history and every moment of history, and the King beyond the end of the final age. All right, let's see if I can squeeze in the third one. Turn with me if you would. You know what? I'm not going to squeeze in the third one. There's just too much in this third one. I know I'm going to want to talk for 15 minutes on it. So I'm going to save the third one, Lord willing, for 2 weeks from today, and that is Elkanah, the God of jealousy. And for the others that, if you wrote these in your notes and you just want to have the brief description, Elkanah is the God of jealousy, El Roi, the God who sees, El Dia, the God of knowledge, El Kadosh, the God of righteousness, El Gabor, the God of might as a warrior, and El Yeshurun, the God of the righteous. And Lord willing, we'll tackle each one of those in turn, and we'll start 2 weeks from today with Elkanah, the God of jealousy.